Is that coffee cup lighting up?
It's not a coffee cup. It's an Alexa.
No, I know that's a fucking Alexa. I'm talking about your coffee cup.
Oh, yes. My coffee cup is lighting up.
Why?
It's an ember.
Okay, so how's it special and why is it lighting up?
It's an electronic coffee cup. What do you not understand?
Yeah. I don't understand the point of anything about it.
You plug it in and it charges the battery on the cup, Jen. Why wouldn't you want an electronic coffee cup?
Well, of course, Jen.
Like an electric rock.
It heats coffee to the perfect temperature.
Oh, okay.
And then, like, keeps it warm for you?
Yeah.
Frankly, I liked it better when it was a pointless USB coffee cup. I thought that was kind of fun.
I mean, I guess that does make sense.
Heaton, Jen, your gift is being delivered through whatever former Yugoslavian postal system in Zagreb. But
I'm excited to see the stamp.
Your card is en route, but... This I knew when I saw at the Yugoslavian Museum I had to get for Andrew Heaton. It is Life in Socialism, 1945 to 1980, How People Once Lived. I would say tween aged, maybe early teenager.
Okay, can I just show you? Look how happy these peasant women are breaking bricks with pickaxes.
It's so funny because everything just describes how awesome it is. And then at the very end, they're like, also sometimes we ran out of food. Like, there's always this little fine print at the back.
Looks like I gotta make a children's book now. Thanks. Croatia. And thank you, Justin. I will add this to my this will be on the coffee table.
What's that thing on the front page? It looks
that thing?
Yeah, is that a bomb?
It looks rather phallic to me. I can't tell what that is. And it's got little dots on it.
It's got turd vibes.
I'm guessing it's some kind of scepter or fascia or something, right?
But what?
Is this where the term fascist comes from?
No.
The Romans would have, I think it was in front of the consul. They'd have bearers that would have ceremonial bundles of sticks that would follow them, kind of like a flag. And they were holding fascia. And then that became the word fascist. So maybe that's a fascia. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know what this thing is?
Do you know what that is?
Oh, I don't know. I thought it was a blunt.
All right, I'll find
out. That'd be something that I think would be very valuable in a socialist or communist system is the guy who knows how to roll the blunt, because that dude was very popular in college. Like that is a skill set. That is an artisan skill set. You know, you get like a glass with a bunch of ice in it. You put the wrapper around it. Cut
glass
open
the ice in it.
What? Yeah. I'm just realizing now I might have a lot more knowledge about how to roll a blunt than anybody else.
I know that a blunt is a doobie, but I don't know how ice is involved.
Fine. I just don't need a glass or really any tools.
No, we're talking about a joint or a blunt.
I'm talking, I can do either.
Yeah.
Heaton here, what is the difference between a blunt and a joint?
So a joint just has rolling papers. So you just put the weed in rolling papers.
Uh-huh.
A blunt is a cigar that you empty out. And the cigar is two things, the leaf wrapping on the outside and then the more solid casing on the inside. So you delicately unwrap the leaf wrapping. That's what you put around the glass, the iced glass, so it stays somewhat moist. Then you split the casing. You dump out all the tobacco. You put the weed in there. Usually sometimes if you want to get really, really fancy, you can use like some kind of like honey or something like that to seal the casing back together. And then you take the leaf that was on the ice glass and wrap it around the casing now filled with weed. And that, my friends, is how you roll a blunt.
Huh.
That glass thing I've never seen before. You are an artiste.
That sounds
I was never good at it myself, but I certainly watched it happen plenty of times.
Wait, so, okay. A joint would be like a couple of hits that you'd smoke to get high. A blunt sounds like an almost traumatizing amount of marijuana, based on what you're saying.
It's a very,
not if you have 30 people.
Yeah, it's a social thing.
Okay.
That's a party. Like, you know, you're passing around. It's a good time.
Got it. Okay.
Although one time I did smoke a 5-gram blunt, and it almost broke my brain. that one was too much. That was like me and four friends, and that's where you understand limits.
Yeah, that is definitely too much.
Austin, Texas, all together once again. I'm Justin Robert Young.
I'm Jen Briney.
And I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We're going to talk about whether or not gig work is distorting economic indicators and the push to drop Trump from state ballots for both the Republican primary and the general election, all that plus your emails. Jen, you are barely hanging on right now. you got in to town 5 minutes ago, it feels like, and you are gutting it out. You are playing hurt.
I took a middle of the night nap. I'm up earlier than I think my body wants to be. But yeah, I'm here and definitely happy to be back with my boys.
Yeah. Glad to have you back.
Yeah.
And we're kind of settled in for a little bit of time. And right. we gotta actually plan our trips to the primary states, because that is closer.
It's really close now.
Yeah. It's like eight or 9 weeks away. So,
okay. Yeah.
Just when I lose my A-list for Southwest, I'm going to be on a plane all the time. It's not cool, man.
I might drive. I feel bad. I've been gone quite a lot. I feel bad about leaving the dog behind. So I might take Wallace and just drive to Iowa. It's like what? But
are we actually going to Iowa?
Of course.
Yeah. I think I should probably go. I've never been to Iowa before.
Spoiler alert. It's great. You guys are going to love it. I know the town now.
Well, I'm thinking that like I had a really good time being in Western Oklahoma for Thanksgiving. And I feel like this is probably going to be pretty similar. It's going to be agricultural plain state, except everybody's hyper political. So it's just going to be, is it just like Western Oklahoma? Only everybody can have a good conversation with me about tariffs.
It's like Western Oklahoma, if Western Oklahoma played home to summer camp of everybody in D.C. and New York.
That sounds great.
Because everybody in D.C. and New York empties into Iowa once every 4 years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, last time we were there, me and Kevin Ryan were drinking at one of the hotel lobbies and we saw Donna Brazile house a pork chop. It was a sight to see. I love Donna Brazile, but I loved her so much more when I watched her just dismantle this fucking pork chop.
It will be fun to see these people in person in a small place.
I'm thinking someday I'm going to have to go to Iowa. I might as well do it when there's stuff going on.
Just why does it have to be January? It's going to be so cold.
Yeah, no, it's freezing. It's absolutely freezing. But, you know, it's a good time. And the people of Iowa are great. And there's like a nice little cool area that one of the cool stores, Ray Gun, they carry the Contender. So I always like them, like to stop in there. They got fun shirts, like making fun of the fact that all of D.C. and Washington shows up once every 4 years and pretends to be friends with everybody.
There's some pretty cool, like there's got to be political memorabilia museums there, right? Because like every button that ever was in Iowa at some point. So I'm thinking somebody's got to have like, you know, if you want to go see like Huey buttons or Patrick Moynihan buttons or something like that, like Iowa would be where to find it, right? Is there such a museum?
If there is, I have not been there. And if there is not, there should be, because like an Iowa caucus museum, well, the Iowa caucus really, really stretches back to Carter. Carter was the one to make it famous. And he was thought to be the winner of it. Although weirdly, he didn't win undecided one that caucus, but he did well enough that he put his name on the map effectively. And that galvanized the idea of the primary system being something that could launch a candidate. Kennedy kind of did it in 60 in a cobbled together sort of way. This was the first time that there was an actual pathway delegate wise. And it started in Iowa, and that's why Iowa kind of became famous. And so we have been rock and rolling since 1970 or that 1970 primary ever since.
Now, do the Democrats dethrone Iowa as well? We talked about New Hampshire. Yeah. Okay. So it's just the Republicans that are kicking around.
Yeah. I mean, normally there wouldn't be an Iowa caucus anyway, because there is a sitting president. So we would not, this is a one party caucus no matter what. Although the rules for the caucus are different between Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah.
Republicans made the Iowa caucus sane. You could just walk in, say, I'm for this guy. And that's pretty much it. Everybody gathers.
So they're still doing the barn dance type stuff with the Democrats where they all like shuffle across the room and all that.
If by barn dance, you mean a shouting match over the Howard Zinn section at the Barnes and Nobles. yes, that is the entire electoral model for the Democrats.
Yeah, okay, now I'm getting genuinely excited. Now we'll be front and center when Doug Berman overturns the entire prediction model of the Republican primary. We'll be front and center for Berman mania.
And boy, will Doug Burgum, the actual candidate, be shot.
Man, bad signs for Doug Burgum. He got the name wrong. I'm probably his demo, too, and I don't even remember his name.
Doug Bergman out of nowhere. Although, there might be a late challenger. Presidentially, there's an interesting story that popped up last night. Mark Cuban, the billionaire, yeah. Shark Tank host,
Maverick
owner, quit Shark Tank last night, controlling interest in the Dallas Mavericks for $3.2 billion to, weirdly enough, the wife of Sheldon Adelson, who died a few years ago. He was a Republican mega donor.
Yeah.
And so his wife, now the controlling owner of the Dallas Mavericks, and the speculation, because he has not been shy about political ambitions in the past, is whether or not he is going to throw his hat into the ring to run. And some people think that it's presidential, but I was thinking last night that would be, I don't think he has a shot to be president, but Ted Cruz's seat is up in the Senate. And if he really wants to be a power player as an independent, I would be very curious to see how he would match up against a Ted Cruz and whoever the Democrats.
The Democrats have already done the primaries. Have they or no? For Senate.
No.
Why run as an independent as opposed to
a Democrat?
Democrat. And I ask this because just in terms of ballot access, not in terms of
spiritual. Yeah, I mean, if you're a billionaire and you can roll out whatever you need to and fight for whoever you need to fight for, getting state ballot access is a different thing county by county because you can actually just focus on the counties that you're actually going to need to win. He's a big enough name that if he wanted to run as a write-in, but I think he probably still would be able to secure ballot access as an independent. My thought as independent versus Democrat is that Democrats got to stink to him. And
in Texas. Yeah.
In Texas. And
until I gotta say, there's grumblings that Matthew McConaughey will run for governor. And I think if he ran for governor, he alone might be able to pull off a Democratic victory in the great state of Texas.
I love him.
See? And I think like, if you're running for governor in Texas, particularly as a Democrat, you need to be very Texan, right? Like, I think this is one of the problems Beto had is Beto looks like he just wandered out of Berkeley. Like he's from El Paso. Wait, I'm not disputing anything.
I'm from Texas.
Yeah, okay? Exactly.
Hey, see, I'm just a regular Texas guy. I like chili and crackers. What's
yeah.
Hey, y'all, what's going on?
Yeah. See, conversely, like Willie Nelson, who's at this exact moment smoking a joint someplace. Like Willie Nelson, like sounds like he's from Texas. Like you need to have that, right? Matthew McConaughey, who just is a man in a cowboy hat slumped in a hammock at all times spiritually, I think could, I think he would get enough.
I would be upset mostly because he is, unlike any other city I have lived in, a mascot of the city we are in right now, Austin, Texas. Mm-hmm. He wanders the streets. He's at every UT game.
The chant for the soccer. It took me a while to piece this together. Is, you know, the ole 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 ole. But it's all right. Like he literally,
he's just transmogrified. Beloved by everybody in this little town. That's special.
Are you saying
that is cultural? That is a cultural binding.
Austin would be a bubble compared to the rest of the state, and I might be living in a vacuum changer. I am going to check my NFT on nootropics and figure out if that is indeed not emblematic of Texas.
I just think the thought of him running is infinitely better than the reality of him running and us finding out exactly how seriously he
probably
takes
it.
Well, he's also from Uvalde.
He is.
That kind of politically radicalized him too.
Yeah.
So he's from kind of red Texas, beloved by blue Texas. And plus he's Matthew fucking McConaughey. Who doesn't love that?
My point
would
is.
Would you vote for him over Abbott?
I have to see his agenda.
Yeah.
See, and I guess this, I like this idea, but it might be that I'm in love with the idea.
Yes.
I don't think that actors have any particularly unique insight on politics compared to any other occupation in the country.
They don't.
And for some reason we go, they're famous, therefore. And
well, actors, especially gigantic ones like Matthew McConaughey, are well-versed and extraordinarily adept at, in the course of 3 months, learning a lot about a kind of person and portraying that person. If Matthew McConaughey has to play an astronaut, he's going to credibly read enough and talk to enough astronauts that he's like, oh, this is how I am an astronaut. I just know these kind of things and these kind of mannerisms, and that's that. Not historically known as the deepest thinkers on the planet, and not to say that they are dumb, but they are their skill set, the artisan craft that they have created is literally designed to upload information and flush information out at a,
you know, that makes sense. The only person to be the head of a union and president, mm-hmm, was an actor as well.
He was.
Yeah.
But when I look at what we have
Ronald
now,
Reagan, for friends these, listening,
mm-hmm, these lawyers like Ted Cruz who are collecting big donor money, and I don't know who they're acting on behalf of. Like, at least with someone like Matthew McConaughey, who got arrested for playing his bongos naked in the woods, like, he's a real person to me. I think there's a chance he might give a shit about regular people because he's been working with extras and dolly grips and regular people for a really long time, where I think a lot of these politicians, they get completely separated from the working class, and they've done so much ass kissing of the donor class that I think that's one of the reasons why I'm kind of attracted to the idea of a Matthew McConaughey, because I just don't feel like the political class is in touch with us anymore, where I think there's a chance that his at least motivations could be
somebody that maybe, I don't know, was on television, you know, somebody that speaks to the average person.
Like who?
I don't know. Like maybe on NBC, you know.
Are you talking about Trump?
I don't know. You're the one who's bringing this up.
Trump was a completely different. I mean, even in his
totally different, no, totally different than the archetype.
Than
you
Matthew
literally
McConaughey?
Just
what? Yes, totally, I mean, different. Even in his TV show, he was portraying himself as better than everyone else in the room. He's the king of the room. He's firing people. Like, yeah, I don't think being on television necessarily makes you a certain thing. I like Matthew McConaughey over Greg Abbott all day.
Well, sure.
If we're having a popularity contest, I also like Matthew McConaughey more than Greg Abbott. And I say, like, yeah, I would agree. Like, I'm like, we don't have to get too hyper Texas on this. Having only been here for a couple of years, I do not like one party states. Texas has always been a one party state. I think it's deeply bad for governance. And so kind of everybody gets two looks from me if they're not a Republican. They might even be a good Republican, but like, you already get kind of a +5 from me in the state of Texas if you're not a Republican, just because I want to break up that monopoly. That being said, I see so much bad governance come from good intention, poorly executed, that I don't place a lot of stock in that. Of somebody's heart's in the right place, if they don't know what they're doing and they don't have a grip on how policy works and how economies work, I think they could actually cause a lot of damage while still having good intentions. So that,
I like to call that phenomenon blue state city DAs, including the one here.
At this point, though, I'm more concerned about people who do know how government works, who have bad intentions and know how to implement things that fuck us over. So, and I look at Greg Abbott as one of those, especially as a woman in this state. So, yeah, at this point, I'll take the guy who plays the bongos naked in the woods.
I'm not good at being able
in
to
his house
psychically intuit.
I know,
which
and
is
he got
weirder.
Arrested for that.
Yeah, he got arrested.
Government overreach.
He must have been really, really banging those bongos, though.
I know, right?
Like, because if you're getting calls from the neighbors, like, that's a lot of bongo playing.
I'm actually pretty big on noise violations, so maybe I'm anti-McConaughey. I don't know. I'd have to figure out what the decibel range was.
Let's talk about gig work. New research by Anat Branca and Mary A. Burke revealed that millions of Americans are engaged in casual gig work, not reflected in official employment statistics, potentially skewing the perception of the job market's tightness. Their study, presented at a recent conference, suggests that the employment to population ratio could be up to 5.1 percentage points higher if gig work were properly accounted for. This unreported work, often undertaken by older individuals or those with disabilities, isn't considered quote unquote employment in traditional surveys like the current population survey. By using the New York Fed survey of consumer expectations, Branca and Burke uncovered a hidden labor segment, suggesting a potential new untapped labor supply. These gig workers, often willing to work hours, additional hours for low pay, indicate a readiness for more stable, higher paying jobs, challenging the current understanding of labor market dynamics. Heaton, How should we count gig workers, and is our current understanding of them giving us a skewed idea of modern employment?
I think we're probably going to have to rethink how we look at employment as the gig economy continues to grow, which I think it probably will and is probably a good thing. The historic division in terms of how we look at labor is either looking at working age labor participation rates or the unemployment rate. If you were in office, you want to go with the unemployment rate because it's lower. If you're the party of opposition, you want to go with the labor participation rate because it's higher. And basically the way those two are calculated historically is that the unemployment rate is based off of people that are applying for unemployment benefits at any given time, whereas the labor participation rate factors in everybody that could work that's not working. So people that have quit looking for a job, people that just aren't participating in the economy, which I think is a much more accurate measure. And again, it flips depending on who's in it. With this one, I'm not sure how you would quite just use a blunt number as they're proposing here, where we're just going to factor them into the employment rate. Because I do think that a lot of the time it is somewhat different in terms of how it operates. If we're looking at it in terms of how competitive is the economy for people looking for work, like how, like right now when you drive around town and you see signs that say, you know, we have reduced staff right now. We're trying to hire staff. That would indicate that it's a buyer's economy for employees and for workers. So in that sense of making it more competitive in terms of the worker end, I think it would be a useful metric. But in terms of looking at it overall, I see gradients there where the Fed has also done research where they found that I think the majority of gig work is temporary throughout the year. I don't know if it's specifically seasonal, but it's not necessarily people that are doing it full time. There's a lot of people that are doing it as supplementary income as opposed to a full time job. So I think it could be useful as a metric to understand how competitive the job market is. But I also don't know that I would just lump it in for all other purposes.
Jen?
I think it's, I mean, Andrew's really touched on it, but it, how do you define a job? And one of the most fascinating things that I found in these articles that we read for this in this study is that they looked at this like, well, look at all these people that are doing gig work. They clearly are an untapped labor supply. Like they're ready for a corporate job. And I don't think that these employers or even these people that are studying realize that what gig work gives us is freedom, especially yeah. freedom of schedule. And so if we're looking at jobs as those that you are signing up for a certain amount of time that you're giving to this company, something like that, you're not going to be able to take people who are doing gig work and just place them in there. And they're not looking for that kind of gig. Also, like, do you have a job if you don't have employer sponsored health insurance? Do you have a job if you don't have a 401k? Do you have a job if you don't have sick days or vacation days? Like, there's a lot of stuff that comes with that commitment. There's also the benefits there. So it's, I think we just have to kind of define what a job is to even have this conversation. Because when I look at gig work, I see that as something that it's for cash, really. And some people can make that enough cash so where they don't have to go and sign up with some company or create their own company or do anything like that. There are people that do that. But most of the time, I think when you're thinking of gig work, it's someone who's babysitting. It's someone who's driving Uber in their spare time. Like my Uber driver the other day was a full-time student. And so he was doing this outs, but like his job was being a student.
Right.
And this was his extra.
He was supplementing yeah. it that way.
Exactly. So when they're talking about our statistics are wrong because the labor supply is probably different than we think it is, I don't really know that that's true because I don't think that these are people that are open to working a 9-to-5. I think they're driving Uber because they want to drive Uber because they can decide, this football game sucks. I'm going to go drive for 3 hours instead and make some money. Where if you have like a job where these people are saying like our statistics are wrong, I don't think that this is a plug and play where you can take this Uber driver and plug them into a 9-to-5. I don't think that there's this, you know, untapped labor market that they seem to think there is.
I agree with you. I think that that's a very good way of looking at it, that a significant amount of people, I think the majority in most polling that do gig work are doing it on a supplemental basis or as hobbyists where they're looking just to pick up money. There are people, like there are full-time Uber drivers that are doing it as a full-time job, but quite a few people are doing it as something on top of something else. And so it has a qualitative distinction within it. And where those distinctions, I think, make more relevance and where we can start to parse those terms more is like with the Fed, what they're looking at is just a labor pool, presumably for competitive forces in terms of wages and things like that. When you get into what constitutes a job, which is a good conversation to have, then we can break it down according to like Department of Labor or National Labor Relations Board, where they would delineate between a contractor and an employee. And these are different. Yeah. So a gig worker is a contractor. A contractor works for themselves. They are selling their labor temporarily on an ad hoc basis to somebody else. A babysitter is a very good example. An Uber driver is a good example. Uber drivers set their own hours. That's different than an employee, where they go, you are coming here from 9 to 5. There are certain protections that you are guaranteed by virtue of being an employee. There are going to be certain wage controls that are put in place, like minimum wage, things like that. And it has a whole different range of regulations that are applying to it. But they're different types of jobs, and the distinction becomes very meaningful there.
Well, you don't have the option in a job to say no.
Right.
And I think that that's a big distinction with gig work, because if someone asks you to babysit, you can say, no, I'm busy.
Yeah.
Or no, I don't want to drive Uber today. It's schedule freedom. And I still don't think that the powers that be, based on the way that they were talking about this, understand what we're looking for. They always look in terms of money. So they're looking at this like, well, these people clearly want money. But there's more to it than that, you know? And
flexibility is a really big part.
It is. And I don't think that the corporate titans have figured that out yet.
So what would you define as a job?
Well, you know, I was thinking about that today, because by my own definition, do I have a job?
That's what I would want.
I would say you're self-employed, though. You're not a contractor. You're running your own business.
Yeah, I do have a business.
Do you have an LLC?
I don't. No, I'm still a sole proprietorship. So, but it is classified that way. And I do pay taxes on every single penny that comes in. So, and I feel like I have a job because I work 40 hours a week, but I don't have sick pay. In December, I'm only doing one episode, so my pay will be cut in half. I don't have a 401k. I definitely don't have health insurance. It's like, so by my own definition, I'm not sure that I'm anything other than a gig worker. So I don't know how to define it myself. I don't know if I have a job.
What I found fascinating about this story is, beyond, I think, all the substantive stuff that you guys brought up, is that it's part of this media narrative that I think is being fed by the White House, that we don't understand that the economy is actually really good.
Yeah.
And it's like, even this is like, oh, well, actually, the employment numbers are better. They're good. They're good now. They should be better, because if you actually do the math on gig workers, and while there is, I think, a general conversation to have that, okay, at will contract employment via an app has only really existed for 10 years. And so we should have some kind of thought that gets put into, all right, now when you're 16 and you can drive, you don't necessarily have to go to, you know, wait tables or bus tables like I did. There are more ways that you can start to work. There's more ways that you can work deeper into your life that doesn't involve going and getting a W-2. But it's fascinating that this is the conversation now, as there is this political question of, look at these numbers. All these numbers are great. Inflation's cooling. We have great unemployment. Why are you people still complaining about the economy when all of the numbers are amazing? You're holding it wrong. Please be happier about the economy.
Yeah. And meanwhile, as Andrew pointed out, there are plenty of places right now that are closed on Mondays and Tuesdays because they can't find enough help. Like, I don't understand what's going on in this economy, but what I'm reading here is that they seem to count a job as working for some company. I don't think that I would count as employed by them, even though I know I'm doing something worthwhile, even though I know I'm doing something as value to society. I know I'm working for 40 hours a week, but they are looking at people like me, who's making money in a different way, as untapped labor, even though I am working 40 hours a week. I just find that whole dynamic fascinating. Like, we don't count for them unless we're working.
I think that
who is them?
I think I'm honestly, when I say that,
the
I'm
fat
thinking
cats,
companies, corporations, like unless you are an employee of someone else.
Unless you are a W-2.
Yeah. I think those are the only ones right now that they consider counting.
So, okay, this is fascinating too. And I like this because I think, Jen, we're in the same place on this, which is gig work is good and people should have lots of flexibility. And it's awesome that there are more job options that can accommodate people's lifestyle choices and things like that. I think we're broadly in the same place in that, which is great. There historically, and perhaps today as well, was a kind of authoritarian corporatist model that didn't like that. So like the Rockefellers of the world really liked Prussian style education that we imported to the United States in the early 1920s, because they saw the existing labor market as being very too independent. People needed to be able to take orders. So the Prussian model that we imported was good because it taught people respect for authority and so forth. I tend to swing it today from kind of the other perspective, where the bigger threats to the gig economy, I think it's twofold. One, there's the entrenched business interest. So like Uber got fought most vociferously by the taxi cartel in New York City. That was the biggest. So existing business interests. In California, I'd flip it. Like you have AB5. Are you all familiar with AB5?
Yes.
I think AB5 was an absolute disaster.
Well, maybe our listeners aren't. Can you just...
Yeah. So AB5, I think it's maybe 4 years old now. And I think it's now been modified slightly.
It's been decimated. Punched to hell because it was an exceptionally stupid law.
AB5 was if you were to cobble together a bunch of economic and governmental fallacies and then breathe life into it and let it wander the streets like Frankenstein, AB5, what they basically did is they went, all these gig workers are being taken advantage of by companies that refuse to hire them.
This was aimed specifically at Uber and Lyft.
It was aimed at Uber and Lyft
and DoorDash.
The collateral damage was massive, though. Basically, like it outlawed being a freelancer in the state of California. So you had like photographers that were freelance photographers, where the law said you can only supply, or excuse me, a company can only buy 35 photographs from you per year. If they buy any more, they have to hire you as a full-time employee. Otherwise, they're taking advantage of you. And so what ended up happening was they all went, we'll buy 35 and then quit paying you. And so it ended up having the money coming in for independent photographers. Like there was an arts festival that shut down because the way they designed it was like, if you're a gig worker, which includes musicians, you were being taken advantage of if you were doing your work for a business that is not taking you on as an employee and providing health insurance and whatnot. So like all of a sudden, like musical festivals went out. They've been around for 40 years, went under because they were faced with either increased your cost by 30% by hiring every gig worker, every guitar worker or guitar player. And so it ended up being this massive, like, and even the author of the bill, Lorena Gonzalez, said, look, yes, it ended up killing a lot of jobs, but they were bad jobs. We're still working on this. Like she acknowledged, like, yes, this ended up being a net loss.
It was overbroad, and it was a dumb idea that was shockingly executed even dumber. And, while it passed in the state, there was then a repeal that came through via whatever the thing is when you vote on a proposition.
Referendum?
Yeah. No, it was a proposition in California. Yeah. I think it wound up getting repealed, but it was also watered down before that because even
I don't think that even though it was targeted to Uber and Lyft, I think they ended up getting exempted by it. So it was just
The proposition literally just exempted them.
That's it. Yeah.
So it left all the other dumb stuff. It basically gutted the reason why they put the law in place, which was at the time, it was every horror story of somebody that was driving from LA to San Francisco so they could drive Uber and sleeping, you know, eight people to a motel so they could save time and everything. That was the song of the day. And then, the proposition came in and just accepted like three companies. So it was just a horribly written law for everybody else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very stupid.
But so, I feel like you brought that up for a reason. What was it?
AB5.
I want to have a job market that is where everybody has lots and lots of options, where if you are an employee or a contractor or whatever, your defense against being exploited by other companies is having other options you can go to. Right. So I like the gig economy. I think it's really cool. I've done a ton of gig work. My life is this like hodgepodge of gig work plus my podcast. with California, I saw the threat to gig work coming from the other end, coming from the progressive end of it, of we are going to protect people's interests from exploitation. And they ended up gutting the gig economy in a misguided way of doing it. So I guess what I'm saying is, like, yay gig work, but I can see enemies coming from all quarters on this. And it's a thing where if you know, I'm in favor of the gig economy is basically what I'm saying. Yeah.
Well, because the two entrenched interests in America that are the most threatened by it are, as Jen points out, companies that would want nothing more than for all of us to be put into drone positions so we can fly appropriately, and unions who need people that have steady jobs so you can pay a union rate and a union can negotiate with your boss so you can get a fairer deal. But you need to have a steady job with benefits to be in a union. And that's, you know, a lot of the progressive element of it is that this is anarcho-capitalism gutting potential union membership from the people that would normally be the bread and butter of it. Working class people that want some money.
But back to the original question, do you guys think that the stats are wrong, or do you think...
As much as anybody can take employment stats seriously, as somebody who's followed politics, it's always hilarious to me to watch, depending on who the president is, each party switch sides on whether or not we should believe employment statistics or we should not believe employment statistics. So I think, like polling, it's something that we should take seriously, but not literally. They are generally a snapshot of where we are, a as good as you can do economic model. Do I think that would is if somebody just made their living doing gig work, do I think that that should count more toward the employment statistic? Probably more than it is now, but I don't think that it should count at like a 5.1% change, like they were saying in the study.
I think the only way that they could make that argument is if you're not counting people that are driving for Uber 40 hours a week. But other than that, I mean, they mentioned babysitting.
Yeah.
Like a retired person who's babysitting, as if that person's looking for so much money that they're all of a sudden going to go and work for Walmart. Like, no.
They proposed, I think it was the same or a related Fed article. They proposed that people that are working 20 hours a week or more in gig work ought to be counted as being employed. And I was like, oh, something like that makes sense to me. If it's like a significant amount of time, and it's income to the level that it's getting taxed, that makes sense. But I from where I'm at, I think it also largely depends on what are we trying to figure out using these statistics?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If like, it makes sense to me if we're talking about competitive pressure in the job market, in the same way that if I drive around and I see a bunch of places that, are looking for staffs, that tells me that wages are probably increasing because they're not getting able to, there are people's standards are high enough that they're not doing these jobs. But if it's just like, yay, president, then I'm like, all right, now I think we're getting into like, we're getting into more sleight of hand statistical stuff. And I'm less enthused using it for that purpose.
Patreon.com/we're not wrong is where you need to go if you want to support this program. Thank you to everybody who does that, because you don't just do it for your health. You don't do it for a spiritual uplift, although you certainly get that as well. You do it because you get a bonus episode. And this week, we're going to be talking about our preview of the DeSantis versus Newsom debate on Fox News Thursday night. As many of you are listening to this on Thursday, buckle up, get your popcorn ready. DeSantis and Newsom, they're going to yell at each other while Sean Hannity watches.
I was really hoping George Santos would moderate. That would be...
He's just going to pop up from the set in the back. I'll take it from here, Sean. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. Talk about these ballots. Democrats are making efforts to exclude former President Donald Trump from California's March 5th primary ballot, citing his involvement in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. With the deadline for the California Secretary of State, Shirley Weber, to certify presidential candidates for the ballot approaching, questions arise about the authority and feasibility of this action. Democratic secretaries of state in key swing states like Arizona and Michigan have shown reluctance to exert their authority in this regard. Weber has not taken a definitive stance, but is monitoring legal cases. Meanwhile, Trump's team labels these efforts as political attacks, stretching legal boundaries, and any action at all to remove Trump as he is expected to face legal challenges, especially considering the conservative lean of the U.S. Supreme Court. Apart from administrative efforts, lawsuits have been filed in several states, including California, to compel secretaries of state to remove Trump from the primary ballots. The Colorado Supreme Court is set to hear an appeal on this case, and the Minnesota Supreme Court recently dismissed a similar lawsuit. In California, Assemblymember Evan Lowe and other Democrats have urged the state attorney general to seek a court ruling to expedite this process. Rick Hassan, a legal expert, emphasized the urgency of resolving the matter to avoid potential social upheaval, especially considering the possibility of Democrats attempting to block Trump's certification in the event of a win in the 2024 election. Jen, do you support denying Trump ballot access in these states?
So I think we've established how seriously I take what Donald Trump tried to do.
You're against him.
I never, ever, ever, ever want him to be president of the United States again.
The first time you were in favor of it.
I wasn't as terrified as other people were. But after specifically him and his team coordinating an effort to fake election certifications in seven states, like that is so far beyond the pale for me. I think this is established.
Yes.
That said, what California is trying to do is horrible and ridiculous, because even though I have seen enough evidence to believe that Donald Trump did these things and shouldn't be president, he was not successfully convicted in the Senate during either of his impeachments, including the one that had to do with January 6th, because the Democrats fucking botched it. He has not been convicted in the courts of law yet. And so he hasn't had his due process, even though I think he's guilty of sin. But that is not established. He hasn't gone through our justice system. And then there's also the matter of I hate this part of our system, that we have these candidates that are narrowed down by these two private parties. But that is the way it is. And the Democrats are not the Republicans. This is not their candidate. So who the fuck are they to try to tell the Republicans who they can and cannot put on the ballot representing their party? And then just politically, these morons, you are making it so much easier for Trump to play the martyr. Like, you're just playing into his hands, because right now he's claiming that all of this is anti-Trump. It's Trump derangement syndrome, and they're all out to get me. If they do this in California, which is not one of the seven states where he tried to steal the election, then you're actually proving him right. And even I will have to say, yeah, Trump is being unfairly
persecuted.
Yeah, in a state
using the law.
Yeah, and he didn't do this in California. Now, I do find it fascinating that Arizona and Michigan have shown reluctance, because those are two of the states that had their election certifications
swing states, yeah,
rigged. Yeah, so it's stupid on every level, politically, fair system of justice. I mean, here's once again the Democrats claiming to be the good guys while doing the wrong thing.
The party of democracy.
This is
democracy,
man,
versus authoritarianism.
Like, who are we supposed to root for here? Yeah. So no, I think it's the best way to defeat Donald Trump is to defeat him at the ballot box. I would love nothing more than to win my bet with you guys by having Donald Trump not be the nominee, because the Republican Party is fucking too. Yeah, you're going to owe me $100.
No, we're not.
Was it in total or each? I can't remember. I'm sure we wrote it down someplace.
Let's do each.
This is happening. Let's cash in.
Yeah, I think the best thing for the country would be for the Republican Party to say, no, we think he's a criminal. We think he tried to stay in office. We've had enough of this. We have another option we like better. The Kochs yesterday said that they like Nikki Haley. So the money in the party.
They like Jeb Bush too.
Understood. But like, there is no guarantee. And there has not been a single vote taken, and I think this matters, for anyone in these primaries yet. So I think it's best for the voters to reject Donald Trump instead of the other party pulling some bullshit because they control the Secretary of State to get him off the ballot. It will only help the guy to actually treat him unfairly.
But not will only, is currently helping. It is the reason why he has separated himself from the field, is that the Republican primary electorate believes that he's being unfairly attacked by his political enemies through legal channels.
And until
this hasn't even really gotten all that much traction in the conservative media circles that I pay attention to, mostly because it's dog bullshit. Bites man to them at this point.
But it's also bullshit. Until I saw this, all of that has rung. It smelled hollow. Like bullshit to me. Yeah. Everything, like the crimes he's being accused of, he either obviously did. I know some of them don't matter. Like, we don't care about Stormy Daniels, but like, he did a lot of these things. But this one is so blatantly everything that they've been claiming that it's once again the Democrats being the worst.
And it's playing, it's like trying to bribe the ref, because this isn't them excluding Trump via the primary system. They are using their power of literally printing the ballots. Like the reason why you certify a ballot is because at some point you have to go to Kinko's and place the order and finalize what's on the sheet that you are going to put in there. And so there are things in place to make sure that that is able to happen. And so you're just going through this very, very technical way to damage his ability to theoretically get votes, that it's just, it's hard to not see it as overreach. But do you see it as such, Heaton?
I agree with Jen 100% on this one. I think that this is anti-democratic and moronic on multiple, like the fact that California is doing it. I don't know California politics super well, but am I right in thinking that it's not really a toss up between Trump and any Democrat in the state of California?
No, despite the fact that California is home to the largest amount of Republicans in the state or in the country, there are many, many, many more Democrats.
Right.
And so,
we are going to try to remove Trump from a ballot in a state where the victory won't matter. It is symbolic, but symbolic in such a way that is only going to help the Republican. It might help whoever the Secretary of State is, if they're just wanting to jazz up the progressive base for when they run for governor or something. But I see absolutely no benefit to it electorally for the Democrats. It's a big problem. The other two problems that I see, and again, I reiterate, Jen, that was a wonderful analysis that I agree 100% with everything you said on that. To add a couple of tails to it, I think there's a, I do not want to go down the road of secretaries of state of individual states start making calls on who's a threat to American democracy and removing candidates from ballots. I don't know. Could anybody, the evil Republicans the Democrats are trying to stop right now, could anybody see the evil Republicans, if this jar were opened, ever doing that in the future? Because I certainly can. I certainly can see Texas going, no, Obama truly, or whoever it is,
one candidate is openly saying, I'm going to use all of these tools against them.
Right.
Donald Trump. The Democrats say, oh, look, authoritarianism. And it's like, well, we can't have it both ways.
The other bit too, is that this goes to something fairly fundamental as well. If we really believe in democracy, we have to trust the electorate to make the right decision. That's how that works. You can't have a situation where you go, Trump is a real present danger to American democracy, which I agree with, and therefore we are going to remove him as an option to the electorate because we think the electorate will vote wrong. If you're removing options from the electorate based on the idea that you think the electorate will vote wrong, you don't believe in democracy. You believe in having dad give fake options to the people to select within a narrow range, and that's bullshit. So just kind of from beginning to end, I think that this is a horrible idea. It's going to have bad consequences, and it's foundationally bad as well.
The idea of being terrified that the idiots are going to fuck this country up by picking the wrong person is a bedrock original American idea. The founding fathers wrote extensively about that.
The whole electoral college, college. Like I don't, it's during the progressive amendments that we get like direct voting for president, where the electoral Congress becomes rubber stamps. But up until like, you would know this better than me. When did that quit being an actual,
we didn't get even direct access to selecting the president, I think, until
it was like up to like 1900. The idea was, look, like the president's a very important job. We don't want everybody voting in this. What you can do is we'll all come together and go, Justin's got his head screwed on straight. Justin, I want you to vote for president on my behalf.
Exactly.
Like you seem to align with my values. And, Jen knows what she's doing. I'm going to vote for Jen. Jen, go vote for president. Let me know who you pick. And that being said, we that is not the system that is being endorsed in particularly in this process.
No.
Well, and I just have to bring it up again that the Democrats, if they wanted to keep Trump off the ballot, impeachment was the way to do that. And the fact that they botched the second one, the fact that they didn't center it around the faking of the election certifications in seven states because they went so fast, they didn't have that information yet. Had they done this correctly, I mean, if you want to keep him off the ballot, you have to have him be convicted by the Senate of the crimes that he committed against the United States. And I think had the trial actually been about the proper thing, I think there is a chance that the Senate could have convicted him. We'll never know because the Democrats decided to impeach him so quickly. But that is the proper process for getting someone like Donald Trump to be not an option. We have a process in place to say that this person is disqualified from being president. And they didn't do it.
Justin, can I ask, it sounds like there's consensus here on the panel that this is a bad move for
dumb
California and for the Democratic Party, particularly going into this. I want to see if it gets even dumber.
Okay.
Back during the last election in Colorado and some other states as well, the Democratic candidates specifically funded MAGA candidates. This is not everywhere in the country, but in certain areas, they funded MAGA candidates.
The midterm.
Because they thought that the MAGA candidates would be easier to beat than the reasonable moderate Republicans everybody wishes
to come back.
And by and
large, they were right.
And they were right. So is California trying to make sure Trump becomes, or excuse me, the Democratic apparatus in California, is it trying to make sure Trump is the nominee? Have they done some internal polling and gone, generic Republican beats Biden, but Biden beats Trump by 1 point. So let's ensure, because it seems to me this is only going to help Trump.
Are you asking me to delve into the conspiracy zone?
Yes. Yes, I am.
So if we're all right, let's.
Am I right in thinking polling wise, the generic Republican is like 16 points ahead?
Well, number one, generic everything is always better because they have no negatives.
Right. Right.
So they are only like the aspirational idea of what you would think. If we were to go into the inner sanctum of the Illuminati and figure out exactly what this conspiracy is, it would probably go a little something like this. Polling shows that the only Republican that Biden can beat right now is Trump, because Trump is so thoroughly defined and he is toxic to a point that it's hard for people that did not vote for him in 2020 to vote for him in 2024. And so unless you saw a wholesale shift of the demographics that voted in 2020 and 2024, then it's going to be hard for Trump to win. We understand Biden to be a weak candidate, and so he needs an even weaker opponent. So yes, we understand that every lawsuit that we bring against him bumps his poll numbers up and makes people, especially in the Republican electorate, want to vote for him even more. And yes, we know that trying to gin up the idea that he shouldn't even be on the ballot and working these secretaries of state also bumps up his popularity. But that's great, because what we desperately don't want is Ron DeSantis or Nikki Haley winning this primary, because then it would be a change election. It would be let's get past all this. Let's get past this old guy stuff. Let's, elect a first woman president. There's a lot of new that happens if either of those two candidates.
Can you imagine if it were actually Nikki Haley versus the old white guy? Like what the rhetoric would look like? So an Indian American who's a woman and children of immigrants and a Republican, that would be a tough sell, particularly.
My mom.
Just resurrect all the old Hillary posters, just put her face on it.
There are women that just want to see the first woman president and would vote for her purely on
that. My mom said she would vote for Nikki Haley. She has not voted for a Republican since Reagan. And my mom was like, I would vote. She's very, very against the gerontocracy. She just feels there needs to be new people in there. And she likes Nikki Haley. Funny you should mention the Hillary Clinton thing. Ron DeSantis' super PAC is just running ads in Iowa that just look like Nikki Haley ads talking about how much she looks up to Hillary Clinton. So every like clip of her saying something nice about Hillary Clinton, they just put it together, and so it just looks like a Nikki Haley.
Wait, so DeSantis is now running against Haley? He's not running against Trump. Is his whole just he's hoping for a colossal heart attack to take out the front runner, and then he can scoop up the bits? Is that the plan?
The plan, it seems now, is that only now is when Iowa really matters. People are really starting to pay attention to it, and so for either of them. If they both lose by 30 points, it's effectively over. New Hampshire's going to happen, but it'll be a fait accompli at that point. If somebody can come within 10, that's enough of a close result that you could say, maybe we get some more momentum in New Hampshire. And maybe if it's Nikki Haley, she can pull off the hometown cooking in South Carolina. And then maybe you can talk the Cokes into spending a gigantic amount of money to actually run in Super Tuesday. But
it's the Coke, by the way. One of them died, but I like
Coke.
I like that they remain the Coke brothers, and there's just like a Bob Marley, yeah. Like a Marley from the Christmas Carol ghost floating around.
I like to think of them like a gag, like the Bloods or the Crips. Yeah. Like they're just the Cokes.
Yeah.
When I read that thing yesterday, it was the Coke Network, and I was like, I don't know what that means.
The Coke-tipus.
The Coke-tipus.
Which is funny that they've, you know, it's just so funny how much the political meta changes that now these people that were like, they were the devil back in the odds.
They've mostly been working on because I know a lot of people at the Coke-tipus, and like most of their activity from what I can tell the last 4 years has been establishing a pro peace think tank with George Soros and then a group called Working Together. I can't remember, but it's like basically yay immigration. Like they've been pro immigration and like, let's pull back on foreign policy. Like that's their big projects at the moment.
Yeah. So Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley are fighting amongst each other to be either second place or possibly pull off the miracle and get some crazy momentum in Iowa.
Well, I mean, Trump's not really running. He's not doing the debates. He's, you know, he loves those rallies just for his own ego, but he's not really running. So I don't see any point in DeSantis or Haley or any of them running on against Trump at this point. It just seems like they need to establish
He's doing, he's leading by 40 points. So
he's just Donald fucking Trump and he's a cult leader. I mean, that's all he has to do.
He seems to be more popular in the party than he was in 2022. So he is winning hearts and minds on some level to people that were not.
Or people who have been leaving the party.
I'm looking forward to seeing what the actual votes are.
I don't know the numbers on this, but is it a fair bet that a bunch of people have left the Republican Party and the people that are still in it are Donald Trump fans, the people who didn't like him became independents?
I don't think that that's
not enough to make it significant.
I think that's third party.
That's
hopium.
Yeah, that's that. Yeah. another question for you. In the news the last several days, I have read so many Nikki Haley ? Articles. Is the media trying to will her into existence? Because I've seen no constitutive reason that anything's changed over the last month.
She's trying to make fetch a thing. Yes, she has seen a booing. Now we had a couple of people drop out. Mike Pence dropped out. Tim Scott dropped out. Theoretically,
but my man Bergman, he's still going strong.
Bergman is still non-existent. Doug Burgum is flatlined into absolute obscurity. But she's gained. I think she is now doing better than DeSantis certainly in New Hampshire. But Iowa, I believe, still remains Trump, the prohibitive leader, then DeSantis somewhere in the mid-teens, and then Nikki Haley slightly below him. And then Vivek, I think, is the only other person that even has a pulse in Iowa right now. But all the other evangelicals, which usually Iowa is the place where the evangelical candidate wins. Like, that's where Mike Huckabee won. That's where Rick Santorum won. That's where Ted Cruz won. And they did it by going church to church and saying, I believe in God more than everybody else. Watch me read the Bible. That's done. We're out of that. That lane does not exist in Iowa anymore. If both Mike Pence and Tim Scott
gobble them up. Like Trump became very popular. Reasons that boggle the mind, he became very, very popular with the evangelical vote within the Republican Party.
He did, so because
his camp now.
His pitch was you elected people that look like you and talk like you for how long, and they didn't do shit. Vote for the Bible villain. I'll actually stick up for you. Like,
vote for the pagan wrecking ball.
Yeah. He's like, I'll actually do it. And then he won. And so he got the opportunity when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died to put the swing vote on the court, and Roe versus Wade is overturned. And that's because he won in 2016. So, well, also because Ruth Bader Ginsburg didn't retire, but
smart move.
Story for another
great
day.
Move there. Yeah.
Story for another day. But yeah, that's where we are now. That's as it stands now by my eagle eye.
Because we went through a lot there. Do you think they are willfully and consciously trying to rig the game for Donald Trump to be the nominee? No. Or is this just idiocy?
I think that this is...
I'm inclined to use Hanlon's razor and say this is just idiocy.
I mean, no. I watch a lot of Congress, and these Democrats really do think that they are the saviors of democracy. Yes. They talk like that, and it doesn't matter what their means are. If they're undemocratic, they're saving the country. Yeah. And these brain worms have infected everyone in the party. Yeah. So they just kind of feel like as long as he's not able to be president, then they've done their job. It doesn't matter if democracy is completely destroyed in the meantime.
We're the good people. Rules don't apply to us. Exactly. They apply to the bad people. We're the good people, as exactly. All people know.
Because it's also very profitable. You raise a lot of money if you're the person who did the thing against Donald Trump. And that, for whatever we can say about the charges brought against him, especially the ones in Georgia and the ones in New York, I am made uncomfortable by elected offices like those district attorneys, them running for office saying, I am going to charge Trump with something, and then them charging Trump with something. Like, mm-hmm. regardless of whether or not we believe that that is accurate, that makes me uncomfortable because now we are wrapping a political motivation into that.
Scene. Yeah, I agree. Well,
I might be asking you something you don't know, Justin, because I don't know as the former California resident, but Shirley Weber, the Secretary of State, wasn't she the person that was put into office by Gavin when our actual Secretary of State, elected by the people, became our senator because of Gavin? Like, yes. Was she even elected by us?
I don't believe so.
I don't think so either. So the fact she's even doing this, like, where's the
democracy? That makes it even less democratic.
And I don't suspect that this will happen. I don't suspect that Trump will be bumped off the ballot.
Yeah,
I mean, I could see that colossally fucking up, like almost certain, like if it's Democrat versus Republican, Democrats are going to win California. You remove the Republican and like, I don't know, maybe everybody does vote green or something.
If
like,
it
I,
is,
I could see that colossally backfiring.
Well, if that happens, it's just an in-kind donation to the Trump campaign. Because I think that stuff like that does delegitimize some of these cases in the public eye. It does look like, oh no, this is Donald Trump's standard line is that this is a banana republic. This is what happens in banana republics when dictators take away the rights of their political opposition by way of the government. And if this happens, that case looks more reasonable to people that are not diehard red hat Trump rally people.
Give them an example that you can't argue with. I wouldn't be able to argue with.
Yeah, I'm a limp-wristed never-Trumper, and even I would go, I got to get out of bed for this. This is anti-democratic.
Yeah.
What about you, dear listener? Why don't you write us in? We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. All together now, we're not wrong pod at gmail.com. I meant to change this title. Cuck Hunt writes, does anyone else think the older couple that picked up Andrew after the Viking Festival was cruising for a third?
I mean, I fucked them. But I just thought that was because we got along real well. Now I feel like they had ulterior motives.
Actually, the OpenAI debacle was good, right? I think the takeaway from the OpenAI kerfuffle is actually very heartening if you care about AI safety. The Achilles heel of the nonprofit governance system is that the board can still make dangerous decisions, whether in incompetence or maliciousness, when acting in majority consensus. Basically, when 5-ish people agree about something dumb or bad, they have no checks or balances. This happened to the nth degree last week and could have crippled the organization and slowly driven the world's best research scientists and engineers into less principled and safe organizations like Microsoft. Instead, the entire company and frankly, most of the AI community was able to outvote the board and preserve the AI company that is loudest and foremost in researching AI safety and alignment.
Whew. My Pollyanna optimism has been reassured yet again. Thanks, listener.
Optimism's nice.
The further we get away from it, and we still don't know what the actual board is going to be for OpenAI. Although I don't know how much of this I can say, I'll tell you guys afterward, but people involved with the formation of that board listened to this show and said that we did a good job talking about it.
Oh, nice. Okay.
That's scary.
So
wait, people or person? Because I know person. But if it's people, I don't know the people.
I know
hello people. Person, by the way. Shout out to you.
I know people listen to the show. Person emailed me.
Okay.
But or texted me. I think he might have texted me. Anyway.
Justin knows people.
That being said, the one thing I will say is that say what you will about Larry Summers. And I know certainly to the progressive audience, he is not exactly the, knight in shining armor, but for, and the, there's some AI people that think he might be too touchy feely and this is a bad addition to the board. The one thing that I can say about Larry Summers is if somebody got really, really hot and bothered about firing Sam Altman the day before Thanksgiving break, he probably would have said, well, I don't know what guys. Wait until New Year's. Let's see if we're all still mad by New Year's and then maybe we do a thing instead of taking a rash decision that wound up being embarrassingly U-turned after, you know, the entire Silicon Valley world erupted. At least that's my
thought. I did love, just my favorite part of the whole thing is how all the workers decided that they're going to resign in Matt. Like that is like cool.
70% or 90% or something like that.
770 out of 790 was the figure that I saw. And a lot of that was like, there were people, there was a woman who had just given birth and was like, I'm still in the hospital and I'm signing this letter. So the only reason why it's not higher for a lot of people is that people are busy. And also all of this happened over a weekend. It all happened on a Saturday and Sunday.
I just think it's a really good example that we can use to show workers the power they have when they collectively act.
Yeah.
Because it worked.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Not a money launderer writes, with his use of campaign finance, what's to say that George Santos didn't create an OnlyFans as a way to funnel more money into his personal account? That way, if he got caught, he's just a pervert and can say, well, I was addicted, but I'm recovering.
I think that's like two levels of grift, which is beyond him. I think he's a one level grift guy. Wait, I got a George Santos joke. Can I tell you that?
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Me and George Santos, we were driving a truck on the highway and the truck was 12 feet high.
Uh-huh.
And we were coming up on an underpass and it said, warning, 10 feet clearance. And I turned to George and I says, George, what should we do? And he says, I didn't see no cops. Keep driving. Anyway, that's how I think of George Santos.
a thing that I put a clip from my stream up on social media about this, but I want to reiterate for this audience. That man was involved in a pyramid scheme and then looked at politics and says, now, that's a surefire way to make money. He thought politics was an easier way to make cash and win friends and influence people than a Ponzi scheme in Florida.
What do you think his deal really is? Like, what is George Santos trying to do or be? Like, he's such an enigma to me.
I'm in the same camp, and I appreciate what Justin clarified. Because exact same thing, Jen, where I'm like, does he think everybody's like him? Like, I'm trying to like create a moral schema that he operates in. And I think the answer is he really likes candy. So he reaches for candy. That's Justin's position is that I so badly like, what was it?
But he ran for Congress twice. Like, is that just ego or was he looking for power for some reason?
The weird thing about Santos in my own headcanon is I do think he genuinely believes in the causes that he says, and he believes the only way he can do it is just by using his natural ability to have no shame and lie. And he also wants Hermes and also Ferragamos and also wants to see whatever dude's butthole on OnlyFans. Like, that's what he wants. I weirdly think that he cares about the causes that he talks about.
Like what causes?
Oh, whatever. Stopping the far left liberal agenda or whatever.
No, but like literally, I don't think I've ever heard him talk about anything of substance. So it's not like I'm going to lie to get into Congress to accomplish blank. What's the blank? Why did he have to do Congress? Because it seems like he could just steal from people.
I love this again. We're trying to make him into some kind of Darth Vader character where we're like, surely he wants to build a Death Star. I think the answer is that he's just a shitty version of Saul Goodman. He's just like a low level criminal that got some sweaters and flung himself at Congress.
He's just slipping Jimmy.
Jimmy.
Yeah. He again, it's just, I want to run for Congress. Why? Because I'm going to be a congressman.
It seems like a good title, and I'm pretty sure I get health benefits. Like, yeah. I think it's something like that. Yeah.
And it's like, and also, like, I need some way to avoid my landlord. Yeah. Keeps looking for money.
So you think the simplest answer is just,
I think it's the right one. It's A to B.
He's a weirdo.
He wanted a thing that gave him influence and power. He got a thing that gave him influence and power. That's it.
Hanlon's razor should be so much more distributed in the world of politics. Occam's razor is the simplest solution. It's probably the correct one. Hanlon's razor is never attribute to conspiracy what could be attributed to incompetency or laziness. And like, yeah. I'm inclined to go with Hanlon's razor on this one. Is he's just an incompetent.
Cause that's the other criminal. Thing is that he wasn't a good liar.
Yeah. No,
he was like you pointed out. It's like, oh, sorry, George, you need to have raised $250,000 to get matching funding from the RCCC. He's like, oh, okay. Well, I raised $251,000. It's like the dumbest. By the way, you want to know what they weren't able to figure out in that ethics report? Why he was spending $999.99 at the same Italian restaurant.
Yeah, they glossed over all of that.
They looked into it and they're like, we don't even know. We have no idea what this was.
The restaurant existed though, right?
Like, yeah,
it exists. Presumably somebody went there and was like, has he ever eaten here? Like,
I think he just listed it. It's like, but even then, it's like, that's the most suspicious thing you could possibly do. Oy. Heaton's friend and collaborator Jennings writes, as the man, if such a moniker can be applied to a limp-wristed soul so innocent of the goings-on in the wide world of sports, who coined the phrase, more hats to you, how in God's name can Heaton not be in favor of celebrating the Thanksgiving and Christmas spirit simultaneously? What? You can't wear a pilgrim hat on top of your Santa hat. Where's your replacement for God called pluralism now, sir? Where's your inclusive, non-bigoted zoning that allows two holidays of different skin colors to live in the same block? Tell me, Heaton, when exactly did you become a communist and a fascist at the same time?
So I think that this horrible diatribe is in reference to my position of let the turkey cool, which I stand by, that you should complete Thanksgiving before moving on to Christmas. And I would like to address this argument on its tenets rather than going for a shallow character attack, but I cannot. Josh Jennings is a piece of shit. He does not understand Thanksgiving. Josh Jennings goes turkey hunting throughout the year with a lawnmower. He runs over turkeys with a riding lawnmower. He's a terrible person. Every picture of Josh Jennings looks like the before picture and the before and after of a more handsome man. He's the only person who's ever been conceived with pre-cum.
Oh, my God.
Deep Black Friday writes, sadly, the name Black Friday has naught to do with the ritual slaughter of financiers. Nowadays, the term refers to the point in the year when retailers finally start turning a profit to get into the black. However, the original reference related to Thanksgiving meant the practice of calling in sick to work the day after Thanksgiving. This was before Thanksgiving was understood to be a 2-day holiday in the 20s and 30s. And hold your commentary, because we got yet another email about the origins of Black Friday. Next Black Friday writes, I've got no idea, but Britannica says Black Friday was originally coined by the Philadelphia police in the 1960s, who rued the chaos and shoplifting that came with the post-Thanksgiving sales. I never realized that this was something that we just didn't actually have a definition for.
Yeah.
I thought it was a cynical label attached to the era of Walmart riots when they were selling HD TVs for $50.
Kind of funny / like, I guess no longer too soon joke of bankers jumping off of ledges in the stock market crash. Well,
that was Black Tuesday.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
But similar.
The world's a little bit less funny. Thanks a lot, listeners.
But yeah, I guess we still don't know. But here's all I do know. Internationally, Black Friday is like a thing.
Yeah.
It was a thing all throughout the Balkans. In the UK, Black Friday is certainly far more internationally known than Thanksgiving and celebrated more than Thanksgiving.
Well, I mean, they shop at the same multinational corporations we do, so they just run the sales online and worldwide. It makes sense.
Yeah, but these were like local Croatian like furniture stores that had like Black Friday advertisements up.
Even Crackdoor
with Walmart too.
Even Crackdoor.
Crackdoors are great.
But they have to compete with Amazon and Walmart. So it's like, as the bigs do, so do the littles. it makes sense to me that it's gone global.
AI mind puzzler, right? So the conflict within AI, it's just the trolley problem, right? But instead of knowing how many people are on the track, both sides are claiming that the other side has more bodies lined up.
I think that's fair. If I'm understanding your analogy correctly, I think that's fair. A less colorful way to describe it would be it is a high stakes debate. If you are skeptical of AI technology, you are very worried that it will lead to a bunch of dead bodies in the future. If you're in favor of it, you think there's an opportunity cost that will result in dead bodies until then. So it's high stakes. It's a good conversation to have.
The devil you know writes, can confirm deviled eggs on Thanksgiving is normal human behavior and Justin is an alien. I've never had it.
Really?
Never.
Had two plates of them this year.
Have you had a deviled egg before?
I've seen them, but you never I'm eat not one? A deviled egg.
They're a delicious way to get cholesterol in my experience. No. I'm a big fan of deviled
I'm
eggs.
I'm weird with yolks.
Really?
I don't like yolk.
So it's, if done like correctly, it doesn't taste yolky.
No. It's got kind of in a very good taste, it's got kind of a mayonnaise flavor to it.
Oh, yeah. Even worse.
You don't like mayonnaise?
Hate mayonnaise.
Oh, I don't think you'd like it. Deviled egg. You should go back to, you know, eating shrimp or whatever.
Yeah.
Florida eat.
Exactly.
What appetizers do you have on your alien table?
Yeah.
I like some charcuterie, a little brajoud. A little brajol, little capicola, little salami. You know,
it was good Thanksgiving. I was just thinking about like to childhood. Uncle Dan's a rancher, and like we'd have Thanksgiving meal, but occasionally we'd have beef, which is not standard for Thanksgiving. But we'd get like hamburgers, and we'd be like, "This is really good." And Uncle Dan would, without joking, be like, "I don't know what killed Stumpy," and like so, we'd get the runty cow that fell over. That was a while back. Now it's mostly turkey.
My biggest problem with the appetizer table is our chips and onion dip. We have Ruffles chips and onion dip, and it's such a thing in the family. And this year I'm like, I'm not going to make a plate because I always eat too much. And instead I just stood over the table and ate half the fucking bowl.
Oh my God.
I felt all the moisture come out of my body. It was so much salt. It was so good.
Cousin JC this year made dessert, which as near as I could tell is just taking like whipped cream and crunching up Oreos and mashing it up. Brilliant. Yes. It's like she made like she figured out how to industrialize the process to where like, how can I make dessert for a bunch of ungrateful people that don't know how to cook that they'll like that I can make in any amount I want in less than 20 minutes. And she knocked it out of the goddamn park.
That sounds so good.
It was really tasty. Mm-hmm. Really tasty. Mm-hmm. Also real quick, just on the note of Thanksgiving, we had our second ever political conversation in the Heaton family this Thanksgiving. First political conversation that I can ever, we don't talk politics normally Thanksgiving, not by rule. We just don't do it. 2016.
Okay.
Uncle Dan, who I still don't know what he's registered as, and I still don't know how he voted, sat next to me and very quietly went, "That election was a hell of a thing." And like that was, and I was like, right. And he's like, "That got weird." Like that was
number one.
This Thanksgiving, we aired our cards a little bit more where I still don't know how everybody voted, but one of the people went, "Andy, you're in politics." And I went, "Yeah." And she goes, "Trump and Biden is the best we can do." And she was like, I've got my preference, but still that's the best. Like there's a lot of people in this country. And I was like, you need to hear about ranked choice voting and open primaries. Man. Was able to bring that into the Heaton family, but also was able, I don't think anybody knew what my politics were. We were able to keep that only, the only person whose politics are very clear is the guy who likes Bill O'Reilly. He's the only one who's got like a klaxon. Everybody else, I don't actually know how they vote. We've kept it anonymous. I like it.
Our family gets very political single year. And I knew which seat not to sit in. I had Joe sit in it and he got to talk to MAGA uncle for at least an hour while I went.
Weirdly, my family did not descend into politics. Although the person who would have done it is my age, my cousin, who has recently become very, very politically aware. So he's the one who probably would have started it. And he was not there because he's expecting his first child.
I had a great time with my MAGA uncle. There's only, again, he's the guy that we know, because my buddy Royce and I have been wanting to make a documentary for some years on this distant outlaw relative in our family named Buddy Heaton, Rodeo clown, been to prison several times. Seems to be some evidence he tried to steal plutonium at one point. And nice. So Uncle Gary is the one with all the buddy stories. So just very quickly, I was like, hey man, if my buddy Royce and I come up tomorrow with some audio equipment, can we just talk to you for a couple hours about like random Buddy Heaton story? And he's like, oh yeah. Like, did you hear the one about the monkey? I'm like, amazing. No, what happened? And he's like, well, you know, Larry Heaton. And I'm like, I didn't get to meet him. And he's like, well, he was at a motel a few years ago and he signed his name late at night. And the guy went, goddamn Heatons, you can't stay here. And he went, why is that? And he goes, well, Buddy Heaton, he came in and he brought into the goddamn motel room a buffalo, which he had, his name was Grunter, and a monkey, and he shit everywhere. And I was like, I've never heard this. How have I never heard the monkey story? So I ended up having a great time. We recorded a bunch of things. Uncle Gary, super fun.
Yeah. What I love about my family is even though we definitely have every range on the political spectrum, we're always nice about it. And I love talking to MAGA Uncle for the just figuring out like, okay, so where are you getting your information from now? And he was spitting out names of, it must be conspiracy theorists that I've never even heard of.
Do you remember any?
One of them, it was either, he either said trigonometry or it rhymed with trigonometry.
Trigonometry is a podcast out of England, I think.
Okay, yeah.
But it's a popular podcast.
In the middle of dinner, he just like starts saying words at me. He was like, oh, you don't know what I'm talking about. I was like, trigonometry? Are we talking about math? Like, I don't know what's happening here. But I didn't understand any of his references this year. None of them. They're completely different.
We are in a rapidly devolving consensus. And I think it's the reason why everybody is so sure of their opinions, because there's not a lot of cross winds. There's not a lot of conversation of like, oh, well, that's stupid in a friendly way, as opposed to, you know, somebody's going to say something in red state will run it, or a conservative podcast or Dana Loesch or something like that. We'll talk about how amazing this thing is on the right. And then Media Matters will destroy it on the left. And yeah, that's that. Like, that's like the entire cross section of political conversation is done in a way that both sides sees as totally bad faith.
Well, I mean, this was different this year in that last year I was hearing the sources and I was at least understanding like this is where you're getting your information from. Now he's so siloed that I don't even understand what information universe he's in, where before I at least understood what, you know, Newsmax was. Like, yeah. I knew the things he was talking about. I did not get 90% of his references this time, which does concern me because it just shows that the siloing is getting more extreme to where we don't even know.
Part of that is just that's the way that media is working. Like yeah, we are just, I mean, but also it's what gives us a career. So like, you know, we should be a little careful about how much we talk about the splintering of media, because that means that there is more as the soil fracks, you know, like we get a little bit ourselves here on independent podcasts. Oh, like
I
don't know.
I think we're kind of trying to be the antidote to that.
Because I concur. I feel that way.
Yeah.
I think we are trying to be responsible, but the fact that there are less people watching the same mainstream stuff means that they want to turn to things that are not mainstream things. And we are not a mainstream thing. Uh-huh. Now, I do think that we are more vegetables than pop rocks, but.
Story of my life.
We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Heaton, who's strolling into the orphanage this week?
So I'm doing a law episode. I like doing law episodes.
Judge Heaton.
Who I've actually asked not to listen to this episode of the show because I think it'll potentially hork off anybody in my family that's a jurist. If you're in a jury and you go behind the closed door and it's your job to say guilty or not guilty, that is your job. And you can say whether it's guilty or not guilty. You don't have to justify that position. You can't be penalized for it.
Yeah.
Which means that if somebody is arrested for they've got a bale of marijuana in their car, whatever the a metric ton of blunts, a whole bathtub of marijuana, bale of marijuana.
I like the
I don't know much about weed. I'm from an agricultural state. Yeah. I picture it a green bale of hay.
I love it.
There's a whole bale of that in the car. It's very clear that the person has been arrested, or that the person has committed this crime, and the crime has been outlawed. The prosecution's made a very good case for this. When the jury goes to the room and deliberates, they could theoretically go, yeah, he broke the law, but I think it's a bullshit law. They don't have to tell the judge why they voted that way.
Yeah.
And this is for good reason that we have the system. We didn't design it this way, but we designed the system to where you can't intimidate juries into making a decision. They have to make the decision for themselves. It has to be a consensus. And when they come out, you cannot penalize them based on their decision. So it ends up being this odd power juries have to temporarily suspend a law. It's called jury nullification. And I got really excited. I got to do like half an hour of story time, heat and mode, where I go back to 1730 and I talk about this early case of jury nullification. I put in like the theme from Matlock. I incorporate Johnny Cochran. And then after about half an hour of setting the stage, I bring on my friend Paul Townsend, who's a defense attorney in New York, and we talk about jury nullification. So
look at that.
Want to learn about that? Go to the Political Orphanage.
Perfect. Congressional dish. Jen.
I took Thanksgiving off, so I don't have anything new. So the last episode was the George Santos, Bob Menendez episode. But what I did do, and I know this is going to be very niche, but over the holidays, I was catching up on this podcast that is about beach volleyball. And I just enjoyed it. And what they said, you know, if you could help us out, like tell people about it. It's called The Sandcast. And so if anyone's interested in beach volleyball, we are getting into the Olympic season. And so they're really following. They do a road to Paris after every international tournament. But they have interviews with all of the best players in the world. After a tournament is won, they talk to the winners. And so I was just catching up on a bunch of these episodes. And it's one of those things where you just feel like you're sitting there with the players. And so if anyone's into beach volleyball, I just highly recommend The Sandcast because I just loved listening to it. I probably listened to like 20 episodes in the last week and a half. So I just want to let people know that that exists.
When
it gives me joy.
When there's like a beach volleyball thing, and is there like an internal American tournament where it's duos that are going up against each other? Because eventually it ends up like America sends duos, right? Mm-hmm. For beach volleyball.
Yeah. So every country can have a maximum of two teams that go to represent them.
Two teams of two.
Yes. And so on the women's side, we could actually easily send 3 to 4, but we only get two. So we do have a domestic tour. It's called the AVP, but that actually has nothing to do with who we send to the Olympics. That's just our domestic thing. It's the FIVB World Tour. That's where we're decide who goes to the Olympics. The
two teams are.
Yeah. And so, it's looking pretty set on the women's side. It's not set on the men's side. But yeah, the international tour, you can watch the whole thing. It's for $5 a month or so. I have VB.TV. And so I'm watching all these tournaments all over the world.
And we dominate, right?
Well, on the women's side.
On the women's side.
George Santos alone won 5 medals.
On the women's side, there's a Brazilian team that's insanely good. They're number one and they're pretty far ahead. But we have number 2, 3, and I think 7 right now, which really sucks for the 7th place team in the world to not get to go to the Olympics.
Gotcha.
Like that fucking sucks. So we're great on the women's side. We have a team that's young and dominant and very exciting on the men's side that they're going to the Olympics. Miles Partain and Andy Benesch, they're amazing. And then there's about 3 teams that are in the running to be our second. But at this point, we're not even guaranteed a second team because all of them are kind of on the struggle bus. So the men's side is really the one to watch right now. But yeah, I think we're going to send, no matter who goes, we're going to have amazing Olympians. And the sport is just so great. But our domestic tour, which I, full disclosure, used to work for, our domestic tour is a mess. They just haven't figured out how to do this yet without losing millions of dollars. So they're going to try something new next year. Awesome. So they're going to have 8 different cities. And I know nothing about this. No one does. But they just announced they're going to have 8 different cities. And so there's going to be teams representing different cities. And Austin's actually one of them.
No. Oh.
So next year I'll be able to physically figure out what the hell this is.
That's fun.
In the community. Yeah, it's going to be fun. But
things that America dominates at.
You will enjoy women's volleyball. Then.
Yeah, I really like
it. I remember we were watching it. Yeah. I think the first live show wasn't even this podcast was not in existence. I think we were just doing a group PX3 thing, but it was we watched it in a hotel lobby.
Yeah,
in Nashville. We watched the final. Yeah,
that was like an initial bonding moment with our
It was a great thing, especially because we didn't have any audio, so we were just watching this
I really like the 20, was it the 2016 or 2018 Olympics where all the pools turned green and they were capybara. Like no one knew what capybara were previously. Now we know it's a thing. Oh, they're anybody having a bad day, Google capybara. They're these like really cute, like large half rodent, half kangaroo things that live in Brazil.
Yeah.
They're really cute.
Brazil, I think, was the 2016 Olympics.
That'd be it then, yeah.
Because we were in Nashville. It was 2021. It was the 2020 Olympics in 2021.
The Japan Olympics that we were, you know, it was a year late because of, I don't know, COVID one. Well, since they're brewing a sequel.
Well, and the
in China currently,
stuff really screwed over our men's teams in the beach volleyball side, and so
finally the real victims.
Yeah, that's the only thing that happened as a result of COVID. Everything's fine.
There's some really good episodes. There was one in particular with Nick Lucena because he was one of the men that we sent, who explained what happened during all of that because we had. Like we had some Olympians that didn't get COVID, but because they were exposed, they were quarantined in some hotel and then they weren't allowed to practice together. So like they were physically on the same court, but a two-man team wasn't allowed to practice together. It was crazy what happened. So the 2020 Olympics, there's some Sandcast archives that I think people, even if you're not into volleyball, you'd be interested in because it's wild what they did over there in Japan.
On PX3 this week, my thoughts in talking to a bunch of other people politically around the world, including immigration. Turns out that's like a big deal in Europe. They really talk a lot about immigration out there.
Geert Wilder over there just took over the Netherlands, right?
His party won. I don't think he will be prime minister, but his party overperformed. And they are
this guy. What's his
name? He is one of the more nationalist voices.
Marie Le Pen type character of the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, look, immigration came up a lot talking to people in both in the UK and in the Balkans. The Balkans, it's a little bit different because they are very, very keen on cultural and ethnic lines as they have Balkanized themselves on those lines for the last, you know, two decades. But
which is weird because it was always great before then. Like,
oh boy!
Yeah.
Oh,
when I lived in Germany 20 years ago, there was so much anti-Turkish rhetoric because there were Turkish people everywhere, and I loved the food. But yeah, it's there's some nasty immigration.
This is one of the things I really enjoy about going to Europe is that everybody in Europe's like, yeah, in our country we like immigrants. We understand that the cultures change and that. As immigrants are good, except for the Turks. There are too many Turks. Like, everybody has like, yes, we're all in favor, except for Polish people, by God.
Yeah.
Like everybody has the one thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It makes me feel better about being an American with our xenophobic tendencies.
That is an American privilege, is that we at least don't have centuries of hatred to build upon our current decision making, for which Europe does not have that benefit. At the end of the day, you have to at least wrestle with the fact that there have been cultural and religious fights on this continent.
It's amazing.
For a very,
it's like,
very, very long time.
Like whenever I'm in Scotland, I'll go to some small town in Scotland, like Sheep Spittle in Galway County or something. And they'll be like, oh no, we hate people from that town because 800 years ago, they stole the bones of a saint we don't believe in or remember the name of. And like, but by God, they're still pissed off.
And they'll pay for it in blood. Or they just won't be able to come to the gas station. That's it. Till next time for Ken Branning, Andrew Heaton. I'm Justin Robert Young, and we're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.